Terry mentioned last Wednesday evening when he was teaching the class how much he appreciated the prayers on his behalf and the difficulty and challenge of this study. David, I appreciate that too. This is a very difficult study, and I think it has been for most all of us. Very challenging, and we need those kind of studies frequently to challenge our thinking and to cause us to think. I think sometimes we don't think with the ability that perhaps we should from time to time. Terry gave us a very brief outline of the things that we're talking about in this chapter. The Persian kings, Alexander the Great, verse 3. The partitioning of Alexander's empire, verses 4 and 5. And then beginning of the wars between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies in verse 6 and the following several verses. And then, of course, the discussion of Antiochus Epiphanes or Antiochus Epiphanes, which discusses a good bit of the remainder of the chapter. The Syrian wars, as Terry, I think, pointed out, we're going to review in just a moment, were a series of six wars between the Seleucid Empire and the Ptolemies during the 2nd and 3rd centuries, or 3rd and 2nd centuries, to get it in order, B.C., over the region of Coal Syria. Now, I may not be pronouncing that right, but we're going to see on a map, the next chart, the area that we're talking about, one of the few avenues to Egypt. These conflicts drained the strength of both the northern and the southern empire, the Seleucids and the Ptolemies, and eventually brought down both empires to the destruction of the hand of Rome and Parthia. Now, in our map, we see, and I think have pointed out in past studies, the strategic location of the land of Palestine. I want to ask you, for consideration's sake, what was all this fuss about? What was all the fighting about? David? All right. All right, a very important trade route went through here, and it had existed for a long period of time. And if my study is correct and my understanding is correct, there was some difficulty in the understanding of who it was that was to control this portion of land. According to my studies, the debate had to do with the Assyrians. They thought that this was theirs by the decree of Alexander. The Egyptians challenged that and thought that that land should be theirs. And so this constant battle back and forth to see who would have it. Terry, you had your hand up. Here?
Yes.
Okay.
And then Ptolemy, in a certain battle, sat on the sidelines and didn't participate, didn't make any contribution to the battle. And so the rest of the Greek generals decided that the Seleucid Empire would be given to Seleucus and not Ptolemy.
Okay. Stage is set.
The stage is set
for the wars to take place. All right. So this little piece of land was a quite valuable piece of land and became the focus of these wars. Terry also set forth for us this outline of the Syrian wars. We won't go into that again tonight, but I think it's important just to look at it and see the verses that are discussed in these wars. Yes, Randy.
I just had a simple question. I thought of last week, but I didn't get it out in time. We're talking about the Greek Empire, the factions or divisions of the Greek Empire, right?
Right.
So would these be considered civil wars?
You could consider them that, yes.
All consider themselves Greeks, right?
It's among the generals that were from Alexander the Great. So
Seleucus considered himself a Greek?
Yes. So you could perhaps refer to it as that kind of war. Terry, help me out.
Well,
Well, James and I were talking the other day, and what was the term you used to describe this? A soap opera? And that's very true as we see it going back and forth. Dave?
These were very four distinct rules, though. It is the Greek Empire, and they're teaching Hellenistic views. That was Alexander's whole purpose.
That's right.
The world could be united. He saw that as the only way. These generals still taught the Hellenistic views. Now, some of them were a little more strict in their enforcement than the others, but they're still separate empires in that they rule over their section.
Well, that's right. Yeah. That's right.
So it
distinctive
is
line.
A Greek empire, but it's definitely divided up in the full city.
Well, you've got this man, Lysimachus, ruling over Thrace, Cassander ruling over Macedon and Greece. And then you've got the Seleucus kings over here and the Ptolemies over here. So, yes, you do have distinct empires, but if I understood your question, it kind of descended from Alexander the Great, the Greek empires. Okay? Richard.
I don't know whether this is the point that people are trying to imply, but the fact of the matter is that Daniel 2 talks about the end of the Grecian Empire and the Roman Empire. So we're not talking about 57 different empires here.
No. For our purposes, though, in our study of this chapter, we're talking about the division among these generals, and in particular these two.
Right.
Those two. Yeah, you're right in what you're saying about Daniel 2, about the cessation of the Greek Empire and the establishment of the Roman Empire. But for our points and purposes, we're discussing these particular two in this chapter. All right? The Seleucids' control of Palestine was from about 198 to 168 B.C. Now, we've already examined the rulers of the Seleucid dynasty who were contemporaries of the Ptolemies during the Ptolemies' control of Palestine. And again, James, this kind of goes back and forth and back and forth over who rules this portion of the land. Now, the following things that I want to talk with you about are the Seleucid rulers who held control over Palestine and the people of Israel after it passed into their hands from the Ptolemies. So back and forth we go. Antiochus the Great, this ruler was only 18 years old when he ascended the throne of the Seleucid Empire in 223 B.C. Even though he was young, he was not without experience. He had experienced governmental rule as the governor of the province of Babylon under his brother Seleucus III. Antiochus immediately began an effort to conquer the troublesome empire of the Ptolemies. Although he was unable to completely destroy them, yet in the Battle of Panion, I think you talked with us about that last week, in the Jordan Valley, he was able to gain complete control over Palestine. Again, James, back and forth we go with this land as it becomes a drama in history. The Jews were at first very happy with that arrangement. They thought this was better than it was. They thought that this constant warring and the drama between these two dynasties might seem to finally come to an end. And so at first they welcomed Antiochus with open arms. But the thing they didn't realize was that the Seleucids would prove to be harsher masters than the Ptolemies. So they thought they had it good, but they didn't have it near as good as they thought that they did. Now, about that time, Hannibal, this is an interesting fact, I thought, in my studies. Hannibal of Carthage, who had been defeated by the Romans at Zama, fled to the court of Antiochus for protection. He thought that because Antiochus was now on top, that would be beneficial in some way to him. But he was still interested in stirring up trouble for Rome. However, he convinced Antiochus to invade Greece, and that was probably one of the biggest mistakes that Antiochus made. Because when he started to invade Greece, Rome declared war on Antiochus. The Romans defeated Antiochus in about 190 B.C. and made him pay dearly for the alliances that he had had with Hannibal. He was forced to pay enormous amounts of money and to surrender his navy and his war elephants. In other words, it put him out of business for the most part. And to ensure that Antiochus continued making his payments, the Romans took his youngest son to Rome, where they kept him hostage for 12 years. Now, this young boy was later to return to the Seleucid Empire, and guess who it was? Yes, Jenny.
I wasn't going to answer that.
Well... I don't know. Terry, help me out. I'm going to defer that question to the historical. Pardon me? Okay, I thought that, but I wasn't confident enough to answer, Jeannie. I appreciate you deferring that to Terry.
Wikipedia here.
Careful.
It mentions that Philip, the one who had joined up with Antiochus III, and they were expanding their empire and everything, later on, Romans defeated Philip and took over that portion of the empire up there in the northern part, whereas Antiochus took the stuff down in the southern part.
Okay, so we got a constant battle going on here. It seems all over the map. The conflict continued. I want, Randy, I know that we picked on you, or Terry did, and we did last week, son. Would you do some reading for me, please?
Sure.
Daniel 11, you're reading from the New American Standard, I believe. I think that's a little bit easier reading and understanding our points in our discussion. If you would read Daniel 11, verses 15 through verse 19, please.
Daniel 11, 15 through 19. Then the king of the north will come and cast up a siege mound and capture a well-fortified city. And the forces of the south will not stand their ground, not even their choicest troops, for there will be no strength to make a stand. But he who comes against him will do as he pleases, and no one will be able to withstand him. He will also stay for a time in a beautiful land with destruction in his hand. And he will set his face to come with the power of his whole kingdom, bringing with him a proposal of peace, which he will put into effect. He will also give him the daughter of women to ruin him. But she will not take a stand for him or be on his side. Then he will turn his face to the coastlands and capture many. But the commander will put a stop to his scorn against him. Moreover, he will repay him for his scorn. So he will turn his face toward the fortresses of his own land, but he will stumble and fall and be found no more.
Here we're talking about Antiochus the Great, who sent forces to the coastland, to Sidon. The forces of the south sent by Ptolemy were not able to resist Antiochus. The text tells us that he stood in the glorious land with destruction in his power. He had authority, if you please. Now, it was mentioned in our study last time that he tried to strengthen his empire. How did he do it? Well, we noted in our study last week that often marriages were involved in politics. And Alexander the Great thought that he could strengthen his kingdom by giving his daughter Cleopatra to Ptolemy Epiphanes in marriage. Now, the problem with that, and Terry commented last week, I'll sit over here and chuckle just a little bit because of the irony of that. This seemed to be a perfect arrangement in the mind of Antiochus the Great. Why? My daughter will take my side. But she did not. She wound up taking her husband's side. And Jenny, you find that amusing. I do too. She wound up taking her husband's side. And so, Antiochus, rather, the Great, was very disappointed. David?
Well, if she's anything like her dad, too, she's down there, she might get a chance to rule her own country.
Well, that's right. This is power grabbers.
You have people that are seeking power, and that means women are involved.
Well, that's right. That's right. So it's not gender-oriented, and so that's right. Now, this conflict continues. Antiochus, of course, as we mentioned from the text there, Randy, had turned his attention to the coastlands, the Mediterranean, in particular Sidon. He was defeated by the Romans, and Antiochus the Great returned home, and not too long after that, he died. Now, after the death of Antiochus the Great, he was succeeded by Seleucus the Fourth, who ruled for the next 12 years. Now, his situation was kind of difficult. Why? What was it that the kingdom of Rome did to Alexander the Great? Terry?
Well, Rome put the Seleucid kingdom in
They broke them.
They broke them. They not only did they have to give up those horses after that one battle, the Romans exacted, because they could, and they had superior horses now, exacted an annual tribute of 1,000 talents. So then that put Syria.
Right.
Okay. Well, so how are they going to pay for this tribute? Well, Syria was forced to tax the nations within its empire, including Palestine.
That's right. And so the Jews had this monkey put on their back to try to pay the taxes that were incurred by Alexander the Great from Rome. Antiochus. I keep saying Alexander, don't I? Correct me on that every time. It's Antiochus the Great. I don't know why I want to say Alexander the Great. But yes, the Jews become responsible then to pay this heavy taxation. Now that created a dilemma for the Jews. The dilemma for the Jews was whether we should pay this for the Seleucids or whether it would be sinful for us to pay this tax and help the Seleucids in any respect. And that divided the camp among the Jews. Now these two opposing factors was led by Onadad, under the leadership of this priest, or the Onadad. Say that for me, Terry. I keep stumbling over that. Onadads, thank you. Onadads, I want to put an extra D in it. But this group of people were opposed to helping the Seleucids in any way. They didn't want to help them at all. Now the other group, led by a man named Jason, felt the opposite. Now he had some motivation behind him as well. But he thought that they ought to make as much money as they could and send it to the Seleucid kings. Now, what was the relationship between this priest and Jason? Anyone studied that part? What was the relationship between them? Well, to make bad matters worse, they were brothers. Now, Jason seems to be interested in only one thing. He wants to be the high priest instead of his brother. So he has some selfish ambitions, and he hopes to accomplish those by offering the Seleucids what they want. He wants to raise these taxes and provide them to the Seleucids. Now, you can read about that in 2 Maccabees if you give that credit, and I think in the history books we should. In 2 Maccabees chapters 3 and 4, Josephus also compliments that in the Antiquities of the Jews. Now, this inner turmoil among the Jews was particularly no interest to the Seleucid kings. All they're interested in is getting these taxes. They don't care whether the Jews fight about how that's going to be raised or not. They want the money. And you see again, politics. It's not a new thing, is it? This tax collector, I want to read with you verse 20. It says, "There shall arise in his place one who imposes taxes on the glorious kingdom." Now, what is the glorious kingdom?
Israel.
"But within a few days he shall be destroyed, but not in anger or in battle." Now, who was it that was appointed to collect these taxes? You've got to have a tax collector. Who collected the taxes? Pardon me? Heliodorus. Thank you for pronouncing that. Heliodorus. Now, this man was sent to gather money anywhere he could. He wasn't particular about where it came from. And as he did so, I want to look with you in 2 Maccabees. You don't have this, but you can listen. 2 Maccabees chapter 3, verses 2 through verse 7. It says, "It came to pass that even the kings themselves and the princes esteemed the place worthy of the highest honor and glorified the temple with very great gifts, so that Seleucus, the king of Asia, allowed out of his revenues all the charges belonging to the ministry of the sacrifices. But one, Simon of the tribe of Benjamin, who was appointed overseer, or appointed overseer, of the temple, strove in opposition to the high priest to bring about some unjust thing in the city. And when he could not overcome Onias, he went to Apollonius, the son of Tarsus, who at that time was governor of Cilicia and Phoenicia. And he told him that the treasury in Jerusalem was full of immense sums of money, and the common store was infinite, which did not belong to the account of the sacrifices, and that it was possible to bring all into the king's hands. Now when Apollonius had given the king notice concerning the money that he was told of, he called for Heliodorus, who had the charge over his affairs, and sent him with commission to bring him the aforesaid money. Now, what does that sound like to you? Here's a man who reports that if you want taxes, these people have it. They have it in their coffers, and they have it in the temple. They have it gathered up, and all you need to do is just go get it. So he sent Heliodorus to plunder wherever he could, even from in the temple, to take those things and pay these taxes. Now, at this point, our attention somewhat shifts to the leader of the Seleucid Syrian Empire, who would have a powerful impact upon the people of Daniel. You remember back over in the 10th chapter of Daniel, in verse 14 of the 10th chapter, this vision of the glorious man who has appeared unto Daniel says to him, "Now I have come to make you understand what will happen to your people in the latter days, for the vision refers to many days yet to come." Daniel is being told what's going to happen to his people. Does that include this heavy taxation and the problems that they're going to have with the Seleucid kings? Certainly it does. Now Daniel is perplexed over that. He doesn't like what he hears, and it troubles him greatly. And so it's going to have a powerful impact upon the people of Daniel. Antiochus Epiphanes, son of Antiochus the Great, brother to Seleucus the Fourth, is who we're talking about, that presents such problems to the people of God. Now Seleucus the Fourth, Pelopater's reign was short-lived. And when we compare that to the reign of his father, he reigned for 37 years. Now in verse 20, let's hold that. David, I want you to read verse 20 for me in just a moment.
I'm just going to bring out the bad guy.
Antiochus? Yes.
He wasn't really aligned with the throne, did he?
No.
His
brother was.
His brother was the king, and when he died, it should go to
his son.
And his son didn't get it.
And why? Tell us why.
There's a king, there's some, this is where the kingdom was kind of has some smaller kings, like Asia Minor had a king, and there's another Ariel there had a king. And Antiochus got them to back him. So with that support, he took the kingdom.
All right. Without even a fight. All right. Just took it away from you. Literally. Yeah. Richard?
I'm going to say, according to this, they don't mention anything about the other battle there that you just mentioned, but it says here that Heliodorus is the one that actually killed Seleucus.
Yes. That's right. He poisoned him. Poisoned him, yes. And you could see some motivation in that as well. In what study I did, I never found why Heliodorus wanted to kill him, but maybe somebody else has some light to shed on that. Yeah, well, yeah. I didn't find a specific reason. I kind of gathered that. Terry?
Mm-hmm. But also, a little deeper in the study, apparently there's, I didn't get the site on this, but there is some actual this archaeological evidence of names and talks about Heliodorus. So we don't only
Okay. Right. I found two or three references historically to this man, but this one seemed to be the most pronounced that I could find. Any other comments or questions? All right, I appreciate you helping me out. In verse 20, let me go back to that. Verse 20. Would you read that for me, Randy?
Verse 20. Then in his place one will arise who will send an oppressor. And I've got a marginal reference that says exactor of tribute.
Okay.
Through the jewel of his kingdom, yet within a few days he will be shattered, though neither in anger nor in battle.
All right. Now, Richard, you pointed this out, that Heliodorus killed him. But it wasn't in battle. It wasn't in anger. It was a political move. And so this is how Seleucus died. Then will come the vile man. Now this is the bad guy, David, that we've been identifying. In verse 21, it says, "And in his place shall arise a vile person, to whom they will not give the honor of royalty, but he shall come in peaceably and seize the kingdom by what, Randy?"
It says by intrigue.
And what's that? And what is that? How is he going to seize it?
Flattery,
the American Standard Translation says. Flattery. So we note that Antiochus Epiphanes was not only one of the bad guys or the bad guy, but he was also quite an eloquent speaker, quite persuasive to say the least. Now, his name was officially Antiochus Epiphanes, the illustrious. But his people referred to him as Antiochus Epimenes, that is, the insane. They saw him as a nut. He was very persuasive, but he was a nut by his own people. Now, you remember where he came from. Back when we were talking about Antiochus the Great and the wars in which he engaged with Rome, and how that he was penalized with these heavy taxes from Rome. It became necessary for them, for the Romans, to have some assurance that he's going to pay the taxes. And so what did they do? They took Antiochus Epiphanes, as he was later called, back to Rome, and they kept him there as a hostage for some 12 years. Now, Maccabees, 1 Maccabees, chapter 1, verse 10, tells us about that. Now, David, you pointed out a moment ago that Antiochus Epiphanes really didn't have any legal entitlement to the kingdom at all. He took it, and he took it by flattery, or as your translation reads, intrigue. Okay? Now, when this vile man came, he shall take the kingdom peaceably, but with schemes. I want to turn with you again to 1 Maccabees. Now, I'm not advocating that we recognize these books as inspired, but we certainly can recognize them as books of history that help us to know some things about what happened during the intertestamental period. And that's the period that we're studying. If you'll turn to, or notice with me, in 1 Maccabees chapter 1, in let's begin where I want to read at verse 29. It says, "And the land was moved for the inhabitants thereof, and all the house of Jacob was covered with confusion. And after 2 full years, the king sent the chief collector of his tributes to the cities of Judah, and he came to Jerusalem with a great multitude. And he spoke to them peaceably words in deceit, and they believed him. And he fell upon the city suddenly and struck it with a great slaughter and destroyed much people in Israel." Now that helps us from a historical standpoint, I think, to know what this man did. He was a smooth talker. He came in and times were peaceable, and he didn't disrupt that until he was determined to let the axe fall. And when he did, he slaughtered many people.
What's your reference?
1 Maccabees chapter 1, I began reading at verse 29 and read through verse 32. Okay? All right. Now, the thing I find interesting about this is, as we have tried to emphasize, Daniel is receiving these sayings from the glorious man by prophecy. He's writing them down. He's recording history before it happened. And here he's recording some bit of history that took about 400 years to come to pass. And it came to pass just exactly as Daniel said that it would. Now that ought to impress us with the accuracy of the Bible, with the inspiration of the Bible, and also with the history of these events as they transpire. Now back over into Daniel chapter 11. Randy, would you read for me verses 21 through 24, please?
Place a despicable person will arise on whom the honor of kingship has not been conferred, but he will come in a time of tranquility and seize the kingdom by intrigue. And the overflowing forces will be flooded away before him and shattered, and also the prince of the covenant. And after an alliance is made with him, he will practice deception, and he will go up and gain power with a small force of people. In a time of tranquility, he will enter the richest parts of the realm, and he will accomplish what his fathers never did, nor his ancestors. He will distribute plunder, booty, and possessions among them, and he will devise his schemes against strongholds, but only for a time.
Let's notice that he would be very powerful. As we read in 1 Maccabees chapter 1, he would slaughter many of the Judeans, many of the Jews. But the problem with this is he was limited only for a time. Who limited his progression? God did. Now, one of the things that we've noted throughout this book is God is in control. God rules in the kingdoms of men. And this event with Antiochus Epiphanes was no exception. He was allowed to do what he did. As ugly as he was, as mean and ornery as he was, as deceptive as he was, but only for a time. God allowed him to practice this only for a time. Now, in Daniel chapter 11, verses 25 through verse 28. Again, we want to notice this reference to time. It says, he shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great mighty army. But he shall not stand, for they shall devise plans against him. Yes, those who eat of the portion of his delicacies shall destroy him. His army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. Both these kings' hearts shall be bent on evil, and they shall speak lies at the same table, but it shall not prosper, for the end will still be at the appointed time. Now evidently the Egyptian kings and the northern king Antiochus sat down, and they're going to have a little powwow. But before that occurs, those of the Egyptian kings, those who eat their portion of his delicacies, would deceive him. They would betray him. And that would cast him into the throat, as it was, of Antiochus Epiphanes. Now both of these kings decided they would sit down and talk a little bit. Did that turn out well? Why? They're both lying. Now, for whatever reasons, they lied to each other. We might say, well, political reasons. Perhaps so. We might speculate on whatever reasons. But they lied to each other. They couldn't trust each other. And this deceit of these kings one toward another caused no resolve between them. And if you'll notice in verse 27, the end did not occur, and the reason is stated, it shall be at the appointed time. It was not the time that God had selected for this to come to a close. Now on his return home, Antiochus, upset because he was unable to resolve things or conquer the southern king, passed through Israel and was moved against the Holy Covenant, the institutions of the law of Moses, and we're going to be talking about some things that he did. Any questions or comments just here? Yes.
$6 billion in debt.
Oh, yeah. 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 Well, that's right. Well, let's look at verses 25 through 28 once again. And notice that this particular change in the course of events was quite important. These two kings, as it were, professed a mutual friendship for each other. They hold apparently the most friendly relations, but all the while each was seeking for some secret opportunity to destroy the other. And neither of them, however, obtained his objective, for the time appointed by God had not yet arrived. The Syrian-Egyptian troubles could not be brought to a finish before the end of the appointed time. I want to underscore that. Again, God is in control. The kingdoms of men are controlled by Him. And these events would not be culminated before the appointed time. The appointed time. Once again, Antiochus Epiphanes will head toward the south. This was his third invasion. This is Daniel chapter 11, now beginning at verse 29 through about verse 30, the first part of that. It says, "At the appointed time he shall return and go toward the south, but it shall not be like the former or the latter. For ships from Cyprus shall come against him. Therefore he shall be grieved and return in rage against the holy covenant and do damage. So he shall return and show regard for those who forsake the holy covenant." Now let's pause there. Antiochus Epiphanes, when he headed toward the south, was not successful. These ships from Cyprus, they threatened him. In other words, when he's got all of his loot together and he's going to go back up to the northern kingdom, a Roman envoy met Antiochus near Alexandria and said to him, "You give up this expedition against Egypt or we'll stomp you." Now, that's a very loose paraphrase. But Antiochus pleaded with them to have some time to consider what he should do. And the Roman fleet just threw a circle around him and said, "You can't withdraw until you give us an answer." And so what did he decide? "I'll pack up my marbles and go home." Now, he wasn't real happy about that, was he? Question or comment? Antiochus really had no alternative. Randy and then David.
My question is, did he have a baby?
Antiochus? Yeah. Evidently he did. But the Romans had a navy. They threw a loop around him and said, "Give up or else."
I was just always picturing the wars going up and down. I was picturing that just on land, but they had a naval.
No, I think they had a navy. Somebody else might have some light to shed on that. David?
We haven't brought it out here, but I think we brought it out earlier a little bit, very confirmed. This is the solution who claimed to be also God, right?
Right.
Yeah. It's brought out here.
The illustrious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, you did say
that. Yeah, the illustrious.
Yeah, I remember he said he was a emperor deity.
Yeah. Richard?
According to the version that I have here, as far as the history goes, this Roman commissioner, Propilius, was telling Antiochus the way it was going to be.
Yes.
And he wanted some time to make up his mind. Here it says that Propilius drew a circle in the sand around the king's feet and said, "Before you leave the circle, you have to give me an answer."
Oh.
And at that time, he said that he would do what the Senate thinks is right.
So it really wasn't a navy. I may have misunderstood that. Circling the sand?
Yeah.
Is that just an expression or literally?
Well, it says that Propilius drew a circle in the sand around the king's feet with the stick he was carrying and said...
Well, that would be literal then. Yeah. Well, either get with the program or else.
Yeah.
So what did he do? He gave up and took his ball of marbles and went home.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, he wasn't real happy about that, so where did he go? On his way home, he stopped by to torment the Jews a little while longer and persecute those that continued to be faithful. Now, one of the things that I found interesting in my studies was Antiochus didn't just fight with his own army. He employed, as he went through the land of the Jews, Jews who were discontent, and used them as well to fight against the faithful Jews. And we can read about that as well in 1 Maccabees, the first and second chapters, to see the accuracy of that. Now, when he came among the Jews, in verse 30 through verse 32, Randy, would you mind to back up there and read for me verse 30 down through verse 32, please? Oh, hang on just a minute. Donna? First Maccabees 1, verses 11 through 15, and chapter 2, verse 18. Might add or ask, how many of you have read some material in 1st and 2nd Maccabees? Okay, good, good. Reading from that is quite helpful, I think, in reading about this period of time. So frustrated, he was going to take his rage out on the Holy Covenant, as it were, the people of God. Randy, please.
Verse 30, it mentions as a marginal reference, Cyprus, but it calls it Kittim. Daniel 11:30-32. For ships of Kittim will come against him, and therefore he will be disheartened, and will return and become enraged at the Holy Covenant and take action. So he will come back and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. And forces from him will arise, desecrate the sanctuary fortress, and do away with the regular sacrifice. And they will set up the abomination of desolation. And by smooth words he will turn to godlessness, those who act wickedly toward the covenant. But the people who know their God will display strength and take action.
All right, this is kind of a turning point in the second part of verse 32. In this instance, the king showed regard for those who forsook the Holy Covenant, that is, the apostate Jews. When he came into Jerusalem, he defiled the sanctuary, that is, the temple, by taking away the daily sacrifices, placing there the abomination of desolation. And by the way, we might want to comment on that just in a moment. That's an important expression. And also by flattering those who do wickedly against the covenant. He'll bring blasphemies against Israel, which he did when he took the city of Jerusalem, plundered the temple, commanded the Jews to worship the Greek idol, which he had set up in the temple, put an end to the daily sacrifices, and polluted the altar by offering swine flesh upon it, forbid circumcision, the observance of the Sabbath, and even the possession of a copy of the law. He was not a good guy, David. He was not a good guy. And so here's what he did when he came into the city. And we want to notice that this term, abomination of desolation, is used to talk about what King Epiphanes did, Antiochus Epiphanes, what he did. Now this same expression is used by the Lord in Matthew the 24th chapter. I want you to turn with me to that. When he talks about the destruction of the city of Jerusalem by Titus the Roman general. In Matthew the 24th chapter, in verse 15, it says, "When therefore ye see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, let him that readeth understand. Then let them that are in Judea flee into the mountains. Let him that is on the housetop not go down to take out the things that are in his house. And let him that is in the field not return back to take his cloak. But woe unto them that are with child, and to them that give suck in those days." Now, the language is essentially the same. When we notice the expression, abomination of desolation, it becomes important. If you'll turn with me to Luke's account in chapter 21, Luke chapter 21, let's read it in Luke's account at verse 20. Luke chapter 21, verse 20. Luke records it, "But when ye see see Jerusalem compassed with armies, then know that her desolation is at hand. Then let them that are in Judea flee into the mountains, and let them that are in the midst of her depart out. And let not them that are in the country enter therein. For these are the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled." The abomination of desolation An expression used to describe what? What does it describe? Terry?
Well, it's actually the
Roman army. All right, as the Roman army. When you see the city of Jerusalem encompassed by the Roman armies, then it's time to flee. How is it used over here in Daniel? In Daniel, the 11th chapter at verse 31. What's he talking about? All right, some have said that the term is used in this first instance to refer to the things that Antiochus did. Used in the second instance to refer to the things that were accomplished by the Roman armies. Now you can take that and study that for next time. But these events were so alike that they're paralleled by the same description. Each caused the cessation of the Mosaic system of worship. Now I want you to think about that between now and next time as you give some consideration to that. But this period of time also identifies those who know God. Yes, Randy?
If I remember right, didn't he set up an idol god?
Yes, in the temple. Yes, and offered swine upon the altar to pollute the altar. David?
I read one who said about how he offered swine, but he got a pit rock and put it over the whole temple.
What?
Yeah. Pig broth. And I read somewhere, I can't remember now where it was, that he required someone to, maybe it was the high priest, to eat the swine. And he refused to do that, and there were severe consequences, of course, that were imposed upon him. You remember reading that?
Yeah, he killed a lot of the priests.
Yes. That's
what I read. I guess that was what he did right at the beginning of the show, that he did that.
But it just seems to me that, the wording is they will set up the abomination, the desolation. Setting up an abomination, yeah. It sounds like setting up an idol god.
Well, in Luke's account, of course, we read the Roman armies being described in that way. In this account, we see the setting up of something which would desecrate, I think, the temple. That's what the Roman armies did, too. When they came into the city, they desecrated the temple, destroyed it completely, and ended the Jewish entity as far as a way of life and a way of worship was
concerned.
Killed a lot of priests. There's some similarities, in fact, many similarities between what Antiochus did and what the Roman armies did. Now, those who know God will resist valiantly. In the 11th chapter at verse 32, I said that the latter part of this verse constitutes somewhat of a transition. It says, but the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. In other words, those who want to do right, are they just going to sit idly by and allow Antiochus to just do as he pleased? Those who want to do right. Well, we want to look at that. This text tells us that they carry out great exploits and they give great instruction to many. And they'll discuss that next week, I guess. Well, what I want you to see and to think about is this enters into the period of what's called the Maccabean Revolt against the efforts of Antiochus Epiphanes. And so we'll talk about that perhaps a bit later and see how that evolves into our study.